Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 46 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. I'm speaking today with Jim Halls, a former Navy SEAL and contractor with the Central Intelligence Agency. Jim volunteered for SEAL training in 1964 and served in Vietnam and later in the Congo with the CIA. He published a book in 2018 titled Cold War Navy SEAL, My Story of Che Guevara, War in the Congo, and the Communist Threat in Africa. Jim's book is a first-hand accounting of this operation, which some people have called the most successful clandestine paramilitary operation in the history of the CIA up until that time. But before we get into Jim's story, I want to take a moment to fill you guys in on the newest tool that I'm wearing and carrying in daily life. It's the Donovan non-metallic knife from Black Triangle. If you aren't familiar with Black Triangle, then you're really missing out. I love these guys because they put the dagger in Cloak and Dagger. If you've been following me for a while now, then you probably already know why Black Triangle is called their newest non-metallic knife, the Donovan. It's named after General William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the U.S. Office of Strategic Services during World War II. Under Donovan, the OSS was unconventional, unexpected, and highly effective, just like Black Triangle's tools. The Donovan is manufactured here in the United States, is made entirely of G10 composite, and comes with a thermoplastic sheath and a couple of amazing extras, which you'll have to see for yourself. You can find it at blacktriangle.com. That's blktriangle.com. You can also get 15% off your first order with Black Triangle using the discount code SPYCRAFT101 or by navigating to blacktriangle.com/SPYCRAFT101. I love mine, and I know you're going to love yours too. So, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm glad that we could finally find time to talk about your story.
Thank you for your patience, and thank you for your invitation.
Absolutely. I just finished your book a few weeks ago, and I knew right away that this was a story that my listeners would love to hear. So I want to start at the beginning with your career in the Navy. Can you talk a little bit about what drove you into the Navy and then into the SEALs right in the very early days of the SEAL program?
Well, remember, in those days, everybody had a military obligation. And my dad was a World War II Pacific sailor, so it never occurred to me that I would do anything other than the Navy. So going right out of college, went to OCS, went aboard ship for a brief period of time, applied for what at that time was UDTR, Underwater Demolition Team / Replacement, and that was actually in 1963, not four. So I went from there to an instructor for the at the training unit, and then when McNamara called SEAL Team 2 for Vietnam, I got a quick set of orders and was the first officer to go permanent duty to Da Nang to join the MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam Special Operations Group. And we actually formed another SEAL and myself and three regular Navy officers formed the Navy Advisory Detachment, took over the operations in the North Vietnam from the CIA. Because McNamara had visited there some months earlier and determined that we liked the operation, wanted it expanded, wanted it taken over by DOD, and that was our job. And that's also how I got introduced to the agency, because we spent some time getting acquainted with what they had been doing in the process of taking over the operation. I was the training officer for all the commandos and the boats, the assistant operations officer.
Oh, wow. And you said you were the first Navy SEAL officer to go to Da Nang, like the very first?
One of two, yes. Mm-hmm.
One of two. Okay, I see.
That was in April of 64.
Ah, okay. I think I recall there's an anecdote in your book about you had an issue with your poor eyesight, which almost kept you out of the SEALs. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. When I applied for officer candidate school, the exam proved that my vision was 20/200. in order to become a SEAL, it was supposed to be 20/20. With my first paycheck, I bought a set of contact lenses. When I went aboard ship in Yokosuka, Japan, I went to the medical unit there to complete my physical, to apply for training. And I took the exam with my contact lens in. And of course, I was 2015. And there was nothing in the forms that asked if I was wearing any augmentation whatsoever. Just took the eye test. They wrote down the result. So I got a set of orders to training in Little Creek, Virginia, reported in. The diving medical, first class diving medical corpsman was reading the medical files. In those days, officers carried their own medical records. My waiver would become a line officer because the worst vision you could have to be a line officer was 2200. That was me. And the waiver was in my medical record. And I could have torn it out, of course, but you know, I just couldn't do that. And so the medical corpsman went through the file, and as he was getting to the end, he flipped the pages, and it flipped my waiver, so I never saw that I had a waiver. So I started training, and I was halfway through training. We were down to basically the hardcore, and I got called into the instructor's hut one morning at formation. After my usual squat jumps and push-ups, one of the instructors said, "Mr. Hawes, how many fingers am I holding up?" I thought, "Ooh, this is not good." So he said, "They want to see you back in officer's country." So I went back to talk to the man whose job I would subsequently have. And he said, "Okay, Hawes, what'd you do?" So I told him. He was shaking his head. He said, "You realize you might be eligible for a court-martial?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so, sir. I didn't say anything, and I didn't sign anything." And he just shook his head, and he said, "Well, you just report over to the ophthalmology department at the hospital." So I went over. The ophthalmologist received me. I said, "Well, son, you seem to be a medical phenomenon. And Bureau of Medicine is curious. You've gone from 2200 to 2015 in less than a year." And so I said, "Well, Doc, here's what happened." And he shook his head and he said, "Well, we'll got to give you an examination." Well, and he did. And of course, it was 2200. And he said, "Well, son, you're 2200. I don't know what to say." And he said, "Doc, that's not good enough. You got to help me." He said, "All I can do is say you're extremely well adapted for contact lenses." So I said, "Please say it, Doc. Please say it." So I got called in front of the senior medical officer of the Atlantic Fleet. And I knew that this was it. This was the court of last resort. This guy had my fate in his hands. So I went in, report tension, Vincent Hawes reporting as directed admiral. So he just looked at me and looked at me and looked at me. Finally, I couldn't stand any longer, and I said, "Admiral, I'm standing first in my class. Don't tell me I'm not physically qualified for this program." And I was so intense, that came from all the way up from my toenails. And he didn't say anything. He just kept looking at me. Finally, he said, "Okay, son, I'll recommend a waiver." And that hadn't been done before. So I go back thinking, whoopee. Well, they quickly process the waiver application. And I get a call from the captain of the Naval Amphibious School. In those days, the SEALs did not run their own training program, their basic training program, but the teams didn't. It was run by a Naval Amphibious School, which did all the amphibious training of all kinds. So I got called over to see the captain. The captain said, "Ensign, I've got on my desk your request for a waiver. How would you like to come back as an instructor?" And I said, "Captain, I'd love it after I've operated for a couple of years." He said, "Ensign, I don't think you understood my question. I got a waiver here on my desk that I could forward either approved or disapproved. How would you like to come back as an instructor?" And I said, "Captain, I'd love it." So he approved the waiver. It went up. I got, so I got orders to the training unit. So that the day I graduated, I went over and reported into the guys who had been busting my butt for the last 6 months. And that was extraordinary because they accepted me like I was a 20-year veteran of great renown, and they were just as professional as could be. So that's how I happened to be there when the executive officer was called and said, how would you like to go to Vietnam on a mission that I can't tell you about? It comes direct, because I don't know. I just know it comes directly out of McNamara's office, and it needs an officer with these qualifications. And if you're interested, how soon can you be ready? And I said, yes, sir, 24 hours. That was it. Went home, kissed my mother, and headed for Vietnam.
Wow. Wow. And you mentioned earlier, once you arrived in Vietnam, I'm still amazed that your whole career and everything that played out afterwards, it was kind of hanging on that one meeting there in the end. So, yeah, but it worked out.
Well, it's amazing that a Navy admiral would be that flexible. No, that says a lot. That says a lot. It says a lot.
It does. First ever waiver, like you mentioned. But, I mean, you make a great point that you were first in your class, so how could you not be physically qualified to continue?
Well, I didn't end up first in the class, but I was at that point.
Well, served its purpose then. That's good.
Yeah. Really.
You mentioned earlier that you were on an advisory detachment. Can you talk about what that entailed day-to-day basis while you were in Vietnam?
Well, we agency operation that we took over had, you may have heard the TV program China Beach. It's about Vietnam and China Beach. Well, that was our beach exclusively, and it was off limits to anyone. And the agency had developed 5-6 little camps about a mile apart along that beach, and had a training compound and so forth. And it was to train the commando groups that we were sending north on various kinds of missions into North Vietnam. It was the most politically sensitive operation in the country at that time. So I was in charge of the training of those commandos. And at the time, we had the first 3 SWIFTs with the U.S. Navy. And because the Navy had no small boats in Vietnam, Pop, the first small boats that we had to operate with were the SWIFTs. Then they brought in, and at the same time, the Navy was scrambling, and they brought in what we call nasty class PT boats from Norway, and they were fantastic vessels. And so I was in charge of the guys that were training those crews as well. And then coordinating, because the boats were the taxis that took our commando groups into the north. That was my job. It was one of those few instances in military history where, because nobody knows what's actually happening, the only thing that mattered was your qualifications. And so I had a job that would normally have gone to someone of a considerably higher rank, and responsibilities accordingly. So it was a terrific learning experience, and I worked with some terrific people, some terrific Vietnamese.
That's amazing. And what rank were you at the time? You mentioned ensign earlier. Were you still an ensign?
No, I was a Lieutenant JG by this time.
Okay, I see. So can you talk a little bit about what differentiated the Swift and the Nasty class boats from other watercraft that were in use at that time? I'm not really familiar with those too much other than what I've read in your book.
The Swifts were actually developed in Louisiana for the offshore oil industry to take crews and equipment to the offshore oil rigs. They were very, very rugged. They were aluminum, 50 foot long. They'd go about 25 knots. And we armed them with 50 caliber machine guns and 60 millimeter mortars that we fired for illumination off the fantail with a couple of sandbags and a board. But the Nasties were 95 foot boats. They were laminated plywood with Napier Delphic high performance diesel engines. They'd do 45 knots. They had a 40 millimeter weapon on them in addition to the machine guns and for the 50 calibers that they had. It was a fantastic boat.
Yeah. Wow, yeah, it sounds big and fast and heavily armed.
So they basically superseded. The Swiss were still used, but the Nasties were the ones that went up into the north, far into the north.
So, and there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about in Vietnam as well. I know that you mentioned this story. You brushed up against the Gulf of Tonkin incident one night, didn't you? You were kind of adjacent to this very historic event.
Depending on who you talk to, our operation into the north was either total waste of time and money, or it tied down a very large number of North Vietnamese because of the harassment we were doing along the coast in North Vietnam. But occasionally we got lucky. And the night or two before the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we got lucky on the island of Han Nu and Han Mat, which are sort of in the pathway to Port of Haiphong. So the North Vietnamese were very sensitive about Haiphong because that was their logistical lifeline in the Red River, where they received cargoes of weapons and everything else from the Russians and the Chinese and so forth. By the way, we were never allowed to touch the bridges, which kept that river navigable. The Red River would have silted in 6 weeks. That's how much silt was in it. No, we were never allowed to touch those dredges. And I'm just making that point because I still get angry about it.
I bet these were North Vietnamese dredging boats you're talking about, I guess?
Port of Haiphong, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Hmm. That's what kept the port.
Well, that's too bad. Yeah, that could have set them back quite a bit.
Kept the port open, yeah. Anyway, so we hit the islands Han Nu and Han Mat and one other Han something. And some people think that's what provoked the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
So, yeah. Oh, wow. Wow, and that was just a couple of nights later then that actually happened?
Yes. And all our operations, by the way, were approved, came out of the National Security Council, McGeorge Bundy's office. Westmoreland and Saigon didn't have anything to do with approving our operations. They were kept informed, but it came straight out of the White House. So you can imagine what that was like. We had, these desk-bound warriors back there that didn't know the coast, didn't know the people, didn't know diddly squat. But anyway, they went into a panic and were concerned that the North Vietnamese were going to retaliate. So I took the nasties down to Cam Ranh Bay. And in those days, there was nothing in Cam Ranh Bay except the Junk Force training base, Vietnamese only, and one pier. And the Dai Huy, the captain of the Junk Force training base, actually hunted tigers on the peninsula. I mean, it was beautiful. It was prestige. It was whatever. Anyway, someone went down there to supposedly hide out from any retaliation. And the only thing that I had to navigate with was a 1903 French chart. So it was just me and the Vietnamese and the boats. It was fascinating. So we hung out down there for a couple of weeks until everyone was satisfied that there wasn't going to be a retaliation at the port in Da Nang. And so we went back to Da Nang.
Hmm. So how much time did you spend in Vietnam altogether?
A year.
A year. Okay, well. And what made you leave the Navy at the end of that tour? I mean, it sounds like you had a very successful and fulfilling tour. What made you transition over to the CIA?
Well, I was going to go back to Vietnam. I was going to take the first platoon to the Delta. And of course, that was a completely different type of operating. So I got a hold of the detailer, and he gives the assignments in Washington. And I said, look, this is different, totally different kind of operation in the Delta. I'd like to go through a training cycle with my platoon. He said, but that means I got to cut short my time here in Da Nang by a month or two. And he said, oh, you can't do that. Sorry. Wow. Just can't work it out. And I said, okay, well, I'll get a half a training cycle. So then my replacement showed up. Actually, I got, when I told you rank inflation, which is typical, I got replaced by a higher rank than me. One of them was in my training class. So I said, geez, Kurt, I wish you'd gotten here a little sooner. He said, well, I could have. I've just been sitting around waiting for my date of departure. And I thought, well, you SOBs, you're too lazy to do the work you should have been doing. I had the duty. I picked up the phone. I got right through Saigon switchboard, right through Hawaii switchboard, right to that detailer. I said, my name is Hawes. My file number is 653959. I'm on a voluntary extension. I want out of this Navy within the next 30 days. Well, he couldn't do anything. I was on a voluntary extension. So in came my orders. And so I went through San Francisco, processed out, went home, spent a week or so, and then headed back for Little Creek. Because by this time, I'd cooled off, and I was ready to sign back up. I'd go back to Vietnam. I got to Little Creek. I was getting ready to do that. I got a call from the only other SEAL that had been officer that was in Da Nang when I arrived was actually had been what they call sheep dipped. He was embedded into the agency. He had gotten out of the Navy and had gone to the agency. He'd get ready to start the CP program, and his wife was about to have a baby. So he called me and said, Jim, because he and I were the only two guys who had SWIFT experience, turning out to be very important in the Congo. And he and I were the only two guys that had SWIFT experience. So he called me and said, Jim, you know, they want me to go to the Congo, and I can't say no, but I really don't want to go because I'm starting the CT program and Barbara's about to pop. And we said, are you interested? He said, yeah. So I said, okay. And so I get a call from the head of the maritime branch of the Special Operations Division of the agency, and it's Bill Hamilton, and he was formerly commander of underwater demolition unit, and hell of a guy, Naval Academy graduate, naval aviator and fighter pilot in Korea, and now he was head of the maritime operations branch of the agency. So he said, come on up, let's talk. So it was easy for him to check me out. And so we got up there, he asked me a few questions to make sure I really knew what I was talking about the SWIFTs. Well, that was it. I went to an operations familiar. I met the division chief, who was a heck of a guy. And these guys had to make these decisions to send a 25-year-old guy to the Congo on his own with no supervision and lots of weapons. Yeah, okay, this young man's the guy. So I went to an operations familiarization course down in Arizona with what was called an air proprietary. Did with civilian type business, but was really a cover for agency air operations and other things, including they trained smoke jumpers there. So I went down to 3 weeks to get a familiarization course on who I was working for. And then I headed for the Congo.
So they already had the parameters for the Congo mission in mind, and were they just looking for the right person to lead it, and then you come along?
Yeah.
I mean, they brought you on specifically for that mission?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
That was fortuitous for you, certainly, that your friend decided not to go, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It was, it was pure luck. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So just after a few weeks of training, sounds fairly minimal. You were already on the way to Congo and you just had to make all the decisions on the ground?
It was my previous training and qualifications that they wanted. I didn't really need anything from them other than to sort of how to behave the manners of the company.
Ah, okay. Okay. And so about what time did you actually make it into Congo? Was this in 65, I guess?
65. I think it was around July of 65. Mm.
And you were totally out of the Navy by this point. You were a civilian, like a contracted employee for the, you were not sheep dipped?
I was a contractor.
Once you arrived in the Congo, this is a brand new environment for you. What was it like there? I mean, how did it differ from the Vietnam environment you'd just come out of?
Well, it was much more primitive. I mean, it was agency. It wasn't Department of Defense. The agency was much more agile, much more delegation of responsibilities and authority. But my boss was a terrific guy. And he met me at the airport in Kinshasa with Leopoldville in those days. Basically, he said, look, I'll back you any way I can, but you're 1,500 miles across the jungle on your own with no communication. So there's not going to be a whole lot I can do. But he was supportive as it was absolutely possible. He was a hell of a man. But that was the nature of it. It was basically, okay, there's a problem out there, go solve it. And of course, then we had in the pipeline, part of their concept was, this was after the massacres in Stanleyville, which you're probably familiar with.
Know a little bit about it, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, so they finally, Washington, D.C., the 303 committee decided that they needed to be an interdiction of the supplies and weapons coming across from Tanzania to the eastern Congo to supply the rebels. And that's what needed to be done. We need to set up an interdiction navy. Well,
to be the nucleus of that Navy, Hamilton, and a guy named Tom Clines, his deputy, also a hell of a guy, determined to put Swift on Lake Tanganyika as the nucleus of what would be the Force Naval Congolese. They went down to Morgan City, Louisiana, where the Swifts had designed and built, and got the Cajuns to cut the boats into pieces, put them on C-124 Globemasters, fly them into the middle of the Congo, come out, put them on a narrow gauge railroad to the port there in Albertville. The Cajuns came out and stitched them back together, and that became the nucleus of the Navy. Then I commandeered several old Lake Tanganyika vessels, and we armed them with captured Russian weapons and so forth, and that became the Force Naval Congolese. The Cubans came out, much to the fear of the State Department, because they didn't want anybody to know that there were Cuban, we had Cubans involved. And they became my training cadre, and we took away from the mercenaries, Five Commando, enough people to staff the Navy, and the Cubans trained them and taught them how to be sailors and how to do the patrolling and so forth, and that became the Force Naval Congolese.
Force Naval Congolese. That's such an incredible mix of so many different things going on there. It's still hard for me to wrap my mind around it. I mean, you lived it, you were there, but you've got the Cubans, and these are veterans of Bay of Pigs, right? These guys are recruited.
Yeah, they're all veterans of Bay of Pigs and or the anti-Castro operations that took place.
Operation Mongoose, I think it was, right?
Yeah, that was one of
okay,
them.
So,
right, that was one of
yeah, you've got these a bunch of Miami-based Cubans, and they've got you fresh out of the SEALs as a contractor. And you've got some of Mike Hoare's European mercenaries all working together. And who's the adversary there? Is it, where are they coming from?
It's the Simba rebels, which were locals. They were communist inspired locals. To say that they were ideological communists would not be accurate, even though Che Guevara thought he could make them that way, which he couldn't. They were mostly just great plunder and pillage. But they were beginning to get better because they were being sent off to East Europe for training and coming back, and they were getting better. So we got there just in time and stopped them just in time. Otherwise,
wow. So the Simba were traveling to Europe for training and then coming back. Wow.
Yeah. Eastern Europe.
My gosh, there's so many things, so many different things going on here at the same time. It's incredible.
One way you could construe this is kind of a lesson in leadership. You know, everybody's in the leadership industry these days. But, you know, that was a situation where I went in and I wasn't in their chain of command. I had to get them to do what I wanted them to do. I had no entitled to give them orders. I did. Unfortunately, they took them. And having the image of the U.S. government behind me, even though they didn't realize how far behind, it was just a big bluff. Mm.
My gosh. So how did you get some leverage in that situation, or how did you show them that they could trust you to lead this mission? You had funds and you had some responsibility, but you didn't have any authority over these guys, right?
No, I didn't. No, that was another thing. They were mercenaries, oh, wow. But I didn't pay them. They got paid by
Five
Commando.
Wow. Okay.
But once again, God smiled. I got lucky and trusted my instincts, and I got exactly the right guy out of the Five Commando that I put in charge of the Navy. And he had been Mike Hoare's regimental sergeant major, which meant he was in charge of all the discipline and all the training for the Five Commando mercenaries. So when I convinced him to come over and run the Navy, I mean, I got every mercenary, so we could pick out the best of a bad bunch.
What was your opinion of this mercenary group as a whole? I mean, they were not like a really disciplined paramilitary force, were they? That was the impression I got from the book.
From the beginning of the operation to the end of the operation, of course, the quality of people deteriorated. So my time there, it was mixed. We had some smart, capable guys, and then we had others who were just thugs, and we had others who were perverts and every kind of low life.
we could possibly imagine. So this ran the gamut.
And I guess that was who you had to work with, right? You didn't have a whole lot of choice. You just pick the best of the bunch.
Exactly. You take what you can get and make it work. And that's what the agency expects.
sounds like it, and it's fortunate that it worked out so well.
Solve the problem.
Amazing. So how big of a force did you end up with? I mean, how many Cubans came over and how many of these mercenaries did you recruit?
We had 15 or 16 Cubans and we had 55 or 60 mercenaries.
Okay. And you had the three, was it two or three Swifts that you brought over on the transports?
Two Swifts.
Okay. And I know that you said you commandeered some other local watercraft. How did that go?
Yeah, we had the Ermans, which is a 5,000-ton Lake Tanganyika steamer that we had armed to the teeth. And we had a 75-millimeter recoilless rifle on it. We had 12.7-millimeter Russian machine guns. But the big thing we had was radar. So at night, that was a big, big thing to have the radar so that we could really be effective at night. And what we had in it, to go it was called the Airman's, the 5,000-ton lake steamer. What we had was, then we had five what today you would call Boston Whalers. They weren't Boston Whalers. They were, I can't remember what they were called. It's in the book. And we had five of those, which we had a 30-millimeter machine gun forward, and we shoulder-fired 3.5-inch rocket launchers aft. So the Airman's, with its radar, would then on the radio direct the speedboats to any targets, because the airmen were slow, but the boats were the fastest thing in the lake, so they could really cover a lot of territory accurately because the airmen had the radar and had the radios to communicate and direct them to the targets.
Okay, and these targets that you mentioned, they're mostly weapons smuggling. Is that going across the lake, across the border?
Yeah. Yeah, weapons, food, medicines, everything. Because somewhere in here we found Che Guevara, and that, you know, of course that's elaborated on in the book. The world really didn't know where he was. They just were concerned that wherever he was, there was going to be trouble. And he, being a romantic revolutionary, the nicest thing you could say, murderous psychopathic thug is really a more accurate statement. But he thought he was going to transfer the Cuban Revolution to other what he thought were vulnerable countries. And the first one he picked was the Congo, which tells you how ignorant he really was. And he brought his merry band with him, who were loyal to him. Anyway, we found him, we discovered him. And say the world didn't know where he was. And so we discovered him there, and he was trying to lead the Simbas. So we made his life difficult and chased him out. Finally, on the 25th of November, when we should have killed him on the 25th of November, we missed him. It's described in the book on how we think we missed him. But anyway, he got away and fortunately went to Bolivia. Got what he deserved.
Right. Bolivia was the last place he tried to export the revolution, wasn't it?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, that's so incredible to me. I'm still, like I said, having a hard time wrapping my mind around it. So your guys, your Cubans, did they know that Guevara was there? I'm sure they were gunning for him.
They're the ones that found him. They were out on the lake at patrol at night. The house radio signals bounce around it at night, and they heard Cuban voice traffic. And you'll never forget, they said, hey, those are Cubans. Well, you know, there was only one thing led to another. And then a few days, we alerted the five commando. And a few days later, the five commando actually came across their camp and the documents that proved they were there.
Wow. I think that if I recall, there was that confusing kind of nighttime battle on the lake. And at least one of the boats got away, and you think that was the one that Che was on at the time, right?
Yes. Can we absolutely prove that? No, we cannot. But all the triangulated get dates and so forth that subsequently come out, and it was highly likely.
this.
Yeah, it seemed pretty convincing to me the way that you laid it out in the book. And I have a hard time putting myself in the shoes of these guys, these, you know, after Bay of Pigs, after Mongoose, and then they are right there, like they're actually firing at him on this lake in nighttime in Africa. It's incredible.
They were so excited. They were so disappointed when we missed him in November the 25th. Oh, wow. Anyway. Oh.
I bet that's my very few interactions with them. I've met a couple now. I've talked to a few over the phone and all that. That's a passionate group of people. They still think about that every single day, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what a story. So after that, you said Che, he left. I mean, you effectively shut down his support to the Simba. Were you able to shut down the Simba as well? I mean, did they, you know, you dried them out basically?
Yeah, unfortunately, what I'm telling you now, a lot of it's substantiated in Che's own book. African Diary, the story of a failure. That's Che's diary. And so what he did was, he finally, his guys came, you know, went to him and said, Che, we'll stay here with you forever, but, you know, we're all going to die here because the Simbas don't care. They just want to rape, pillage, and plunder. You know, they're not here to make a political revolution. They just want to, they said, rape, pillage, and plunder. So he finally said, okay, basically, okay, guys, we'll go somewhere else. So then he had to plan his extrication, because by this time, we were really making it difficult for any traffic to come across the lake. So it's all covered in his diary.
Yeah, it's an amazing read, certainly. How did the operation eventually wind up? I mean, you ended the threat. I mean, you got all of your targets, right? I mean, there was not much else to do at that point.
Yeah, it slowly wound down. Because we ran out of targets. The mercenaries slowly were being disbanded. My corps, I think, left in December of 65. The guys that he replaced really didn't do very much. And the guys that replaced him really didn't do very much. And it just slowly ran down during the first quarter of 66.
Okay, so after that, I mean, were the Swiss brought back to the United States, or were they left there, or what?
They were left there. And of course, within 6 months, they couldn't run because the locals couldn't maintain them. They were simple boats to maintain if you were determined to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's too bad. Well, they had an action-packed lifespan there, certainly. So what did you do after you left Congo? Did you continue working with the CIA after that?
Well, that's something that I really don't want to talk about.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, No, it's one thing to talk about as a contractor, but after that, I'm not comfortable.
Got it.
Not comfortable doing it. I made some promises. And
sure.
That's it.
And can we anticipate a second book from you at any point in the future, you think?
Well, what Brian and I are working on here will be worth something if it actually happens.
Really? Yes. Okay.
There's some stories to tell. There's a Vietnam story to be told. If I live long enough,
okay. Well, I would certainly like to read that one day. The first book was riveting. Like I said, for all my listeners, I really encourage you to pick up Jim's book, Cold War Navy SEAL. It is a fascinating read. I was able to finish it just in a couple of days myself, honestly, once I started. And, you know, we've covered some really interesting points here, and we've only talked about a pretty small portion of the book, honestly. There's so much detail there, so many interesting characters that Jim came across, and so many things that he did. So definitely check it out for yourself, Cold War Navy SEAL by Jim Halls. Jim, is there any way for people to connect with you right now? Do you have a website or anything like that at the moment?
Well, yeah. I mean, I got a telephone number and email.
Okay, I'm not going to give that out to everybody this time, I promise.
Okay. All right. Please take any questions, comments. Like to hear from people who read the book and get their comments.
Okay, fantastic. Are you still involved at all with the Brigade 2506 Museum in Miami? That was how I originally found you.
Well, I stay in close touch with those guys. I mean, we got a bond. I mean, there are not many of my guys left, but we got a bond, and for sure, and a lot of mutual respect. And Manny is doing a magnificent job of getting the next generation of Cubans to stay interested, supportive, and reverential to their progenitors.
Yeah, he really is. And you listeners probably do not know who that is, but he's one of the big forces behind the museum in Miami. And he and I have been in contact quite a bit over the past few months. And he's been very helpful in setting up interviews and just a great guy. And it's wonderful to see this history kept alive, certainly.
And of course, the head of it right now, Felix Rodriguez, is just has a magnificent history as a warrior and a Cold War warrior and a contributor to America.
He certainly does. And he's got, I know his story. I have not had the chance to talk to him personally yet, but I'm hopeful, I'm more than hopeful, really, that he'll be a future guest on the podcast as well. And he can kind of close out Che's story for us as well, because I've heard several parts of it now, and it's good to get the full three acts of Che's life and his interaction with you guys. Well, thank you so much, Jim. This has been really informative, and I hope that a lot more people will not just learn your story through here, but pick up your book after hearing about this as well. I really appreciate your time.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Jim.
You bet. Bye-bye.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101 or connect with me on Patreon. My patrons get exclusive access to long-form blog posts that dive deep into some of the most amazing stories in the history of espionage and receive free or discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. That includes a free PDF copy of my own book, Spy Shots Volume 1, 101 True Tales from the World of Espionage. I want to say a big thank you to all of my patrons, including Lauren M. and James J. With your support, I've been able to continue funding my research and publication across multiple platforms to date. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Thanks for listening to this program brought to you by Daydreamer Network. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred platform. Your feedback allows us to rank on the best new shows list and continue to grow our podcasts in order to bring more unique and talented storytellers to the network. To check out our shows, including programs about relationships, sports, business, nutrition, leisure, and more, head to www.daydreamernetwork.com. We look forward to seeing you back next week for another great episode. Have a wonderful day.